Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and congratulations on the film. You have had, I guess, your own relationship with John Keats over the years. If people have watched your films know that as early as An Angel at My Table, you have a character reciting from Keats, and in your recent film, In the Cut, you also have some Keats. So could you talk about your love affair with the poetry of John Keats?
You know, actually, it's not as... For me, poetry has been a late joy. I think I had problems with it when I was young because I found it quite hard to understand. I used to feel stupid. But as I turned 50, I thought, I've got to make some effort, turn this around. And I read Andrew Motion's biography of Keats, thinking, you know, getting the context and the situation would probably help me. But what I wasn't prepared for, about halfway through the book, John Keats met Fanny Braun, and as you've probably seen, it's a remarkable love story. I think as powerful and as pure and innocent as Romeo and Juliet in its own way, plus it really happened. And there's 33 love letters and notes that Fanny Braun kept her whole life, and then her children sold. So we actually do have the exact letters that Keats wrote Fanny and Fanny read. And I found that was just moved me so much.
And you were reading this during, after your last
probably,
film?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, you know, like 8 or 9 years ago. But it made me go and read his letters. There's quite a few good collections of Keats's letters. And they're fantastic because he talks about everything. And he's very funny as well as he's serious. He talks about the soul and his theories about it, about poetry, but also very gossipy and... funny, you know, witty and light and warm. And I kind of fell in love with them through his letters. But I couldn't imagine a film, you know, and like people are allergic to poetry, really. So they don't not like it. They feel aggressive about it. Hmm. What happened was that I came up with the idea of telling the story through Fanny Braun, who I also really loved. And I thought if I do it with her, then she can meet him, fall in love with him. She also wasn't a natural lover of poetry. Like, she learnt about it through Keats. And then we'll have the most intense time of Keats's life, the time, you know, when he was 23 and he wrote his great odes and he also was in love. And also Keats's death when, you know, she loses him. And I felt it would be a way to... you know, there's a bulk of material, and I thought it'd be a way to control the material. And once I had that idea, I asked, Francois Yvonneau is here today, our Pathé financier, asked me what I wanted to do next. And I said I had this idea of a love story, and he didn't even know who Keats was because he's French. Supposing you here, Francois. But he responded to the story and he said, let's do it. I mean, I was very surprised, but it just has gone on that way. I always thought I was going to be making a very, very small film. But it's one from the heart for me, and I've just adored that exploration I've had into his life, and feel for me he's like a friend, you know.
And of course you have, it's also a sort of an interesting triangle, because you have this other great character of Brown, who is, you have sort of a love triangle where it's, instead of two men in love with the same woman, it's one man and one woman in love with the same
man. Yeah, Brown's a beautiful character. In some ways I feel most like him because he's someone who can see talent. And I think as a director you often feel like that. You're the one that's looking at the actor's work. Yeah. You know, who are out there and exposing themselves, and in those moments when they really fly, you know you can't do it, and you're just so, I mean, I feel so enthralled with them when they, you know, are doing stuff you couldn't imagine.
Right.
And so I feel like Brown is the guy that wants to be the poet but can't, and his best friend is the poet. And he wants to protect him, you know?
And of course, you know, as the director, as somebody who observes talent, you have to find, you have to cast. I mean, the casting is so vital, and you found these great actors, Ben Whishaw and Abby Cornish, who embody these roles.
Paul Schneider.
Right, and Paul Schneider is Brown. So could you talk about that, about casting?
Oh, casting is, it makes you feel quite neurotic because you don't know your film very well at the time that you're casting. Quite often, it's well ahead of pre-production, and it's going to make such a difference to how the whole film goes.
Yeah.
But my experience now is that, you know, people kind of come to the roles and they claim them, and my job is just to sort of notice who's grasped it. And in this case, it was definitely Abby Cornish and Ben Whishaw.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Schneider was a late arrival. I was really imagining I would have an English actor, but I loved him so much in the Jesse James movie that I saw in Venice when I was a judge there, and just had this hunch that he could do it.
The film has a great combination of feeling sort of observed. It's very literary. The script is very literary. It starts off with this great sort of banter in that opening scene, you know, with Fanny putting down Keats and his poetry. So this is great dialogue, but it also feels as though you're really observing it, that this is just happening in the present. It's, I think, of all the period films that I've seen, and I imagine people feel this way, this one really feels like it's just happening in the moment. It doesn't feel like...
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's this part of time in my life, but or the story in particular, but I really wanted to have a sense of just being from the actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed myself in rehearsal when everybody, you know, is feeling nervous and they're trying to make an impression and we're all stumbling around, and whenever people were sort of like trying to act and trying to push the story forward in rehearsals, it would just like, and I'd glance over and someone would be just quietly reading a book in the corner. I'd go, oh, that looks interesting. It was just whenever people were relaxed and the work was coming from that place that instinctively I thought, oh, you know, this is such an intimate story. It'll be so much more powerful if we really believe it.
And do you go in with a very clear idea of what you want to do visually? There's such a control of light. I mean, the sort of use of sunlight, the way light is a kind of character in the film.
You know, I have to give the credit to my DOP, Greg Fraser. He's really young. He's about early 30s. But I made a short film with him. And again, I just think he thinks like a camera. So, and he did, you know, he just loves his work. And I remember when on the short film, one of the first shots was of a horse rolling, and I was rehearsing the children somewhere, and it was like a pre-shot, and I went out to, you know, it said at 3 p.m. we'll shoot this shot, and I went out to join him with his crew. And he said, oh, I already shot that one. I was like, I didn't know whether to be like, you know, really furious. Like, I'm the director. You should be waiting for me. This is outrageous. And they said, I'll just show you. Maybe you want to do something else. And I looked at it and I went like, you couldn't have done better. This is like a dream, you know, when you have a talented young DOP like that. But one of the things I think I went into the film with was this idea of classicism, that I didn't want to have a lot of director shot signatures. I wanted to keep a very simple frame, and what ended up really happening was that I think it gives a slightly sort of 3D feeling as you move around and inside and with them, but the camera is not pulling attention to itself in any way. It's doing the opposite. It's allowing you to look where you want.
Mm-hmm. And the film, the relationship between Keats and Fanny has this combination of restraint and passion. I mean, the passion often it comes out in the words. And there's a chastity to the relationship, which is a little bit different than some of the relationships we've seen in previous films. But there's real power to it. So could you talk about that? Sort of.
I think what I was really taken by the story was the connection between the two people, and the tenderness, really. And I think it's what everybody really yearns for. I mean, sex is great, but connection and, to me, sensitivity, tenderness are values that are things that I really value. And the story seemed like an opportunity. It seemed like it was central to it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about for you, why does he leave at the end? Like, I know you sort of say that, or
he
explains it very beautifully in the film, yeah. But...
Yeah. Yeah. Our kids, why did he go to Italy?
Right.
It was a painful thing for him in reality. I mean, I'm telling you because I know all the ins and outs of it, but in reality, the doctors told him you will not survive another year, another winter in England. That's not possible. You must leave. Maybe, almost certainly, he was going to die anyway, and I think Keats had a lot of regrets, a lot of second thoughts about going to Italy, and there was a time when his ship couldn't leave. It kept being pushed back towards England, and he had to come back on shore, and he then thought again, perhaps I'll just go back and be with Fanny back at Wentworth Place with the Braunes. But he did leave, and I think part of the reason why he left was he had been the witness to two family members who died of consumption, his mother and his brother, who was only 19, as you see in the movie, and I think he didn't want Fanny to see what was going to happen to him. He studied medicine too, and he knew what was coming to him.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't want to go out like a frog croaking in the mist.
Hmm. If you could talk, work both as writer and director, and I'm just wondering if you can talk about how you kind of divide up these two steps in your mind. When you're writing, are you visualizing shots?
It's like I'm split personality. The hope, I think, well, directors that don't write, I think, imagine I've got such an advantage because I'm probably thinking it or seeing it all in shots, but I just don't do that. Right. I tend to write as if it's happening in the real world, as if it's 3D. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sort of in the room, wherever, around them. And I don't think in shots. It's just like happening.
Yeah.
And then later on with my director hat on, I try to find that thing, that kind of harmony between form and content, find a way to shoot it that really works with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And with who I am too, mm-hmm. and how I respond to it.
The costume design is so expressive and so beautiful throughout the film. So could you talk about that, about your involvement?
I think the film, because of Fanny's obsession with fashion, naturally the costumes were important to us, and also that they were hand-sewn. And probably you people here don't know this, but Fanny Braun's uncle was Beau Brummel, who was the... famous Regency fop. I wanted to include in the story, but the facts were in 1818 had already been exiled to France. So I made it one of my kind of precepts to stick with the timing. As obviously I don't know really what they said to each other, but I used the truth of who was around, what the timing was, to just minimize the fantasy.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you one thing and then open it up to questions from the audience. But it has been 4 years since the last film, and I'm wondering if the time, in terms of the time that you had to take time to let this develop and to maybe think and read, and it seems to be on the screen here in the film in a way. And I wonder if you could talk about that, because I think we probably all know directors who crank out a film every year, and we wish that they wouldn't make so many. I'm not going to name any names, but
You know, when I it's actually probably 6 years since I last made a film. I made a short film, but I think as I really did take that 4 years off, sincerely not knowing if I would make any more. I thought it was time for me to think about, you know, maybe I'd done everything I needed to do or wanted to do in film, and I had a young 8 or 9 year old daughter. I wanted to just be a parent, and just. You know, when you make a film, it has to be like a necessity. It's such a hard job. It's such a compulsive, obsessional project. You know, film can take all of your time and then more some, you know. I never feel I'm enough for what I'm doing. But with this story, I kind of calmed down a lot. I mean, I remember a time when I was doing my job at the time, which was doing nothing, and I was sitting in a paddock with some horses, and I had a little thermos of coffee. They're just a ragtag group of horses I used to like to sit with and read, and they all wandered off except one mare, and I could see she was really interested in what was in the bag that was next to me, and she was just standing quite patiently, and then after a while she used her hoof very gently to lift the lid of the bag. And then she put her nose into the bag and just sort of sniffed to check whether there was any carrot or apple or sugar. And I was watching her doing it right close to her, and I just thought, you know, that's what I love. You know, that tenderness, that gentleness, that's what I, you know, have come to appreciate now in the world. And I felt kind of confident. I thought, you know, the story, Bright Star, has those qualities. You know, those are qualities I want to stand up for.
We probably also have, this is probably the tenderest, most understanding mother we have in
it is, isn't
in
it?
Your films. So maybe the
there is another mother than the Jane Austen mothers, yeah.
Okay, so we have time for a few questions. We'll start over here. Did this film make you rethink your own films, or
I guess the seriousness of what this couple went through, their genuine feeling for each other, the tenderness, it made me want to be very simple about the way I did it. You know, there wasn't any room for my flourishes; didn't need it, and it just made me feel. Giving them a very good, clean stage. It made me feel classical about it, you know, wanting to do that. I think what's been the gift to me from this film is that I have felt more confidence about poetry in my life, and, you know, I read a lot more of it. And it's a bit like planting a garden in your head that can bloom, because you can go back to the poems and they never quite hit you the same way. I used to think there was a definitive interpretation of a poem, but now I know that's not the case. There's some things you live with and they're very hardy. You can't really fuck them up. They'll survive you.
Do you read any French poets?
I can't read French, sorry.
Well, what poets or what other poets?
Well, I like Walt Whitman and Robert Frost. I like Elizabeth Bishop. I mean, I've really got a pretty wide appetite for poets. I'm just thinking of some American ones right now.
Down here?
I have a question, but first I must say that there were times when I was watching this and I could see it right coming in and I was like, how the hell did I do this? Because it seemed to me that you had undertaken a virtually impossible film, which takes the time for all the great lonely water.
Thank you.
So he wants to know about the rehearsal process, in case you didn't hear, and how you developed this rapport, the closeness between the actors.
You know, I was stumbling in the dark here, and I had to, because I was doing it in different ways. You can see it's more sensitive, there's somehow more being, you know, up there in the stage than I've normally been able to achieve. And I remembered this concept that Keats has called negative capability, and it's... You know, when I first mentioned to the actors, one of them quipped, yeah, so it is a little bit negative in the room. I was like, no, it doesn't mean that. But what it means is the capacity to stay in the mystery, in doubt, without grasping after fact or reason. And it's like we all had to build those muscles, that we had to create a space, that we didn't have to have the answer straight away, that we almost had to just not know for a little while and let things develop, let things evolve without going, well, you should stand there and you should do this and you should do that and, you know, the point of the scene is this. And it for me, it was about, allowing some grace in and having the confidence to do it, because people get nervous. They get like, you know, well, this doesn't seem like a real rehearsal. What's happening? Shouldn't we do the scenes and, you know, shouldn't we find out what the point of it is? And, you know, I could come in here. I could be carrying something. I could be doing the tea. And I'm just going. So it was like I had to last them all out, you know. Sometimes I just sit in the room with them, you know. And we have scenes that we want to look at, and there was more dissent than I've ever had in a rehearsal. And I guess, you know, that's something I've probably tried to avoid before by moving things along. And, you know, I think slowly people came to understand what was happening. Dissent together with me, you know. Because it's uncomfortable in that space, you know, when things aren't moving ahead in a clear. Are people with me here?
Did they just want like specific actions?
Yeah,
they
didn't very feel like clear they, tasks.
So
yeah.
They didn't feel like they were.
They didn't know what we were looking for yet, because right. We hadn't found it. It was like I was waiting for everyone to just calm down, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'd go like, you know, it was just like that. Then you'd just go like that. That's working over there, you know. And I say, I'm just reading my book. Yeah, well, that's great, you know. Mm-hmm. You're not trying, you're not doing anything. It was like just dropping down. Everyone's had to drop down into themselves. And it's like, you know, that alchemy that has to happen between the actor's actual personality, their actual charisma, and the character that they're presenting. Also, a couple of our actors had some major accents to cope with, you know, like Abby Cornish is broad Australian. And, you know, she had to find her English accent or Fanny's accent, you know, which is really hard when you're doing very, you know, sensitive personal work. Yeah. To find, you know, to be halfway through learning your accent.
Yeah. So how do you know when you have that moment? I mean, because do you just have sort of an instinct about it? Do you have to look?
Yeah,
I feel it
in my body. I feel it in my body when I see something. First of all, I think I'm mad. What's going on? And then, you know, I'll slowly start to see it in people. Or I can remember a moment when the little girl, Edie and Abby, were just reading on the bed together. I do exercises with them, which are very simple, you know. Okay, you're just reading together on the bed. You're just in the room together. Or, you know, Ben, you practice your handwriting. Abby, you sit next to him, practice sewing. And after a while, I'll be watching them, and I think, that's the mood I want. That's it. I'm starting to see it.
And then do you also observe things about them that you don't tell them? Like, for example, a number of writers said that Ben Whishaw sort of looks like a cat or acts like a cat. It's something some people have said. But I don't imagine you tell him.
You look like a cat.
Right. That would probably not be a good thing to tell an actor.
Yeah, you have to resist, you know. I'm imagining most people here are interested in directing and... It's you have to watch what you say. I mean, it's never a good idea to say that's what I want you to do.
Right.
And you know, my actors speak to me pretty plainly, and I'm happy for that. Like, I remember Paul Schneider saying, "Don't tell me what to do. You know, I'll never be able to do it." And you know, he'd say, "Use verbs." You know. Okay. And you know, I let them do that, and so I wrote down all the verbs, because it does help. It really is. It's hard for them when you say, when you pin something, because it's in their head and they can't repeat it. Nothing can be repeated. So I'd say that's the general idea, you know. we're in the right area now.
Yeah,
that's the sort of closest I get. Or, you know, when I'm actually shooting, I'll just say, hey, you know, it's feeling good now. Let's just keep doing a few more.
And have you been evolving more?
Or I might say, I can see your plan.
Yeah,
is showing up. You know, to an actor, you've got to drop it now. You've got to trust yourself.
Have you been like evolving towards this? I mean, is your approach different in this film than on earlier films?
Maybe I have been evolving towards it. I don't quite know. I mean, I can also see the point of doing something which is incredibly mannered.
Right.
I mean, it is a choice. Everything is a choice.
Yeah. Okay. It's time for a few more. So over here.
I mean, in the end, what you're trying to do is get to a truth somehow.
Yeah.
I think this film is so emotional, so I was trying to get a space, you know, where the audience would feel unmanipulated, where they were not manipulated, in fact, but it was just the story was there for them.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. With the child, with Toots, with that character shows up at important times. What were you
she actually,
about
thank
that?
You for reminding me about her. Toots, Margaret, or Edie, as she really is. She was such an important talisman for us in many ways because she did embody that quality of delicacy just naturally. And I remember when she came into the rehearsal room, everyone was, like lounging around and, you know, and she came in and she's like a little butterfly arriving. And she was really there already where everyone else had to go. And people could see it, you know, and it would have been so easy to kind of crush that thing. But what the feeling was that isn't it a miracle that someone like this is here in this world? And you did not want to hurt it. You wanted to protect it. And, you know, she also, you know, created that leadership in a way.
Yeah. And there's also quality to Keats, a child-like quality. I mean, there's a rapport between the two of them.
Yeah, I think both Ben and Abby are great with children and cats. What about our cat? Ben is he's a very instinctive person, and someone who reads energy, I think, and I'm kind of very aware of his energy, and I think directors are people that read energy, and you know you can see if something's troubling an actor or in the pathway, and you know you try to pull it out or name it or move things on.
We have one over here. Go ahead. No, over here. So, question about the sort of muted style of the musical score. Does that have to do with
this? Yeah, we had this issue because we had poetry in the film as well, like quite a lot of it. I personally love the music in the film, and it's very simple. It's all working off that Mozart piece that the guys get together to do a vocal version of. The duets are the same, and music was done by Mark Bradshaw. He's 23 at the time I asked him to do it, just a really uniquely talented guy. We talked about it, and what we did was we didn't want to tell people how to feel, so you'll find that there's no, you know, as they're about to come up to kiss or something, there's no music. We're not saying, here we go, this is the moment. We don't feel any need to heighten it. You know, you just have the experience you have of it. But afterwards, what we did was, like, in a way, capture the what had been collected by the storytelling, and that's where we'd bring our music in. So after the kiss, there's quite a heightened moment when they're both remembering that time in their separate ways. She's in the room and the wind's wafting up her dress and he's on the top of the tree. I think it was a conscious choice to keep the film classical. Simplicity was like, keep it simple, stupid. It just felt like, to me, as I said, the stories are very powerful, and I didn't need any signature from me.
Okay, we just have time for one more. So down here. Okay, if you could talk about your sense of place. She's homesick for England after watching this film. So.
I think I discovered England in making this movie because, you know, where I'm from, the leaves are always, always on the tree. We don't have a visible season, both in New Zealand and Australia. So it was fantastic for me to discover England through the seasons, to be there through the winter. And you sometimes don't even recognize the locations we chose by the time we got there to shoot them, you know, in spring and early summer. I didn't first read Keats in England. I first read him, I guess, in my classroom at New Zealand and at university, where I kind of pretty much misread him. But, you know, since then I'm a kind of Keats trooper. I've been to, of course, his house in Hampstead. I've been to the house or the little museum, the Keats Shelley Byron Museum by the Spanish Steps in Rome.
Okay. Well, good. Thanks again, and good luck. Good luck with the movie, and see you again.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.